Welcome to episode 1484 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Salome told the story of an ambition she came to regret. After watching James and John give up their livelihood and follow Jesus for 3 years, she joined her sons in asking for the places at his right and left when he entered his kingdom. Jesus answered with a question they did not understand. "Can you drink the cup that I am about to drink?" James and John confidently said they could. They were thinking about a kingdom and positions of honor. Jesus was speaking about suffering, surrender, and the cost of becoming like him. Acts of the Apostles, Part 6, Chapter 4.
The 2 days between the cross and the tomb are something I do not speak about often. Not because they were the worst of it. There is no doubt the cross was the worst of it, but because they were the most alone. My sons were in hiding, somewhere in the city, and I knew where they were, but I did not go to them, because there was nothing I could say that would help, and I did not have the strength to sit with their guilt and my own grief at the same time. Mary, his mother, was with John, as Jesus had arranged. The other women and I stayed together. We had the spices to prepare. We had the practical work women are given in the presence of death, and I have never been more grateful for practical work in my life. The hands do what the mind cannot manage. The spices were measured, wrapped, and ready. The pressing questions that remained: would the stone be too heavy to move, and who might be able to help us? We went to the tomb before dawn on the first day of the week. I was there. I want you to know that. The women were first. The stone was already moved when we arrived. I will not try to reconstruct exactly what happened in the minutes that followed, because memory under that kind of shock is not reliable in its sequence. What I remember is the quality of the light, not yet full dawn, that grey light that makes familiar things look strange, and the absence of what should have been there, and Mary Magdalene beginning to run. There was a young man inside. In Mark's account, he calls him a young man in a white robe, and that is accurate enough, though young man does not quite describe the quality of presence he had. He said what I was told he said, and what I have turned over in my mind every day since.
"He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him."
And then,
"Go and tell his disciples, and Peter."
I have always noticed that specificity. Not just the disciples, and Peter. As if Peter required particular mention. As if the message needed to make its way past whatever Peter was feeling about himself after the courtyard, past the weight of his 3 denials, and reach him directly. "Yes, you too. Especially you." We went out and fled from the tomb, because trembling and astonishment had come upon us, and we said nothing to anyone, for we were afraid. That is how Mark ends his gospel, in most of the manuscripts we have, right there, at the fear. I used to find this troubling. I do not anymore, because I was there, and the fear was real, and the astonishment was real, and the silence was real. Something had happened that was too large for immediate speech. The words would come, but first there had to be the shaking, and the not knowing, and the running. The words came. I went to where I knew my sons had been hiding. John was already gone. Mary Magdalene had reached them first. She had seen the Lord herself in the garden, heard him speak her name, and run to tell the disciples. John and Peter had left at a run for the tomb before I arrived. That is John. Told that the thing he most needed to know might be true, he went to see. James was still there, sitting with his back against the wall, his hands still. I had rarely seen James's hands still. I sat down beside him. I did not say anything. I had been at the tomb that morning and felt the ground change under everything I thought I knew. I did not think James needed my words. He had already heard what Mary had told them. He needed someone to sit with him while the world rearranged itself. After a while, he said,
"I wasn't there. At the cross. I wasn't there."
He meant the hill. He meant the hours he had been somewhere else while his teacher died, and the women stood and held it. I did not tell him it was all right, because it was not all right. I simply said what was true. "He is not in the tomb, James." He looked at me. What I saw in his face was not relief, not yet. It was the face of a man trying to hold 2 enormous things at once. the weight of what he had not done, and the impossible news that the one he had not done it for was somehow still present in the world. We sat there together until running feet came back up the stairs and John burst through the door, out of breath, unable quite to speak. He did not need to. I could see it on his face, the same way I had seen the mountain on both of their faces coming down from Tabor. James took the longest to come back from where he had been, and I sat with him through it, because that is what I was there for. What I want to tell you about the weeks that followed is not the appearances. Others have described those, and with more directness than I can offer, since the appearances were given to others and not to me. What I want to tell you is what I watched happen to my sons. James was different. The impatience was still there. James would not have been James without it. He still wanted things settled, still had little patience for hesitation when he believed the right course was clear. But the fire had been through something now. The man who had once wanted the confrontation to come sooner had lived through a confrontation that came with terrible speed and ended nothing the way he had imagined. He had watched the kingdom he expected collide with a cross. He had seen courage fail, certainty collapse, and the man he believed would reign submit himself to arrest and death. What emerged on the other side was not a gentler James exactly. The strength was still there, along with the urgency and the instinct to move toward rather than away from whatever stood in front of him. But there was weight beneath it now. He had learned that courage was not calling down fire on your enemies or securing a place beside a king. Sometimes courage meant remaining faithful when God did not act as you expected him to act. John was different in a way harder to describe. He had always been the one who held things in his mind longer and turned them more carefully. Now there was something in him that seemed to have arrived somewhere, a stillness that was not the stillness of a man waiting, but of a man who has found what he was looking for and is now living from it. He spoke less, and when he spoke, it carried more. I watched the Pentecost from inside the city. Not inside the upper room. I was not among those gathered there, but close enough to hear the sound like rushing wind, and to watch what happened in the streets afterward when Peter stood up and the 3,000 believed. I watched James in the crowd that day. He was not at the front. Peter was at the front, as Peter always was. But James was there, and his face was the face of a man who had said yes to the cup and was beginning to understand what yes had committed him to. I thought of Zebedee then, the morning my sons had left the boat. The nets in his hands, his face doing the thing it did when he was feeling something he did not have words for. I had asked him, "Did you know?" And he had said, "I saw them go." I understood him better now. There are things you watch happen to your children that you cannot stop and would not stop if you could, because stopping them would mean stopping the thing your children were made for. You open your hands, you watch them go, and you stay, in case they need someone to tell them what they could not see from inside it. That is what I was for in the end. The one who was there for all of it and could tell them what it looked like from the outside. The one who saw the mountain on their faces.
There are seasons when faithfulness looks less like confidence than simply continuing to walk toward the place where you last knew Jesus to be. Salome and the women went to the tomb expecting death. They carried spices, not hope. Yet because they went, they became the first to stand before the astonishing news that changed everything. He has risen. He is not here. Sometimes faith takes us forward before understanding catches up. The resurrection did not erase what had happened before it. James still had to live with having fled. Peter still remembered his denials. John still carried the memory of the cross. Jesus did something greater than pretending those failures had never happened. He met his disciples beyond them and began transforming the very people who had failed him. James's impulsive courage gained weight. John's intensity deepened into something quieter and more enduring. Their failures became part of their formation rather than the final verdict on their lives. That is one of the great promises of the resurrection. God can bring new life not only out of death, but out of everything in us that seems finished beyond repair. Failure does not have to be the last word. Neither does guilt, disappointment, fear, or the collapse of what we thought God was going to do. The risen Christ still calls people out of hiding and gives them work to do. Our task is to keep walking toward him, even when all we are carrying are spices for something we believe has died. To be continued.